This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword.
This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
The Sword and Laser Podcast, episode number 41. I'm Veronica Belmont.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
And we are here at Dragon Con 2010. Yay! Now, right off the bat, we were trying to separate the room into who is a sword and who is a laser. So maybe we can just get a little figure out where we stand at this moment. So if you are on Team Veronica, if you are a sword, please make some noise.
And if you're on Team Veronica and you're a laser, make some noise.
Oh. All right, well, I like this because I win either way, I guess. But lasers, I guess, are representing big time here at Dragon Con 2010. And of course, because of that, we have a very special guest with us tonight, author David Gerrold. Welcome.
Thank you.
David is a winner of a Hugo Award, the Nebula Award, author of dozens of novels, including Jumping Off the Planet, Bouncing Off the Moon, The Man Who Folded Himself, and many of you may know him best as the man behind the Trouble with Tribbles episode on the series Star Trek.
A little series you may have heard of.
As David pointed out before we started tonight, the mic stands were made on Tribble Street in Lithonia, Georgia.
Really?
Coincidence?
I think not.
I think not.
I think so.
What would the skeptics say about that? Swoopy? Yes? Yes. Okay. Well, speaking of the Hugo Awards, the Hugo Award winners were actually announced today. And we have some very special winners, including China Mieville, who wrote The City and the City. He's a great author. I just finished reading Perdido Street Station, which is one of my new favorite books. And also Paolo Bacigalupi, who we've read in the past. Did anyone read The Wind-Up Girl with us? Recently?
What did you... Well, David read it too. What did you think of the book?
Stunning. You want more than one word at a time?
Stunning's fine. If you'd like to spend more words or save them up for the interview, that's your call.
Well, if I were being paid by the word, you could have some more. So. Stunning is fine.
And also, the Best Dramatic Presentation Long Form Award went to Moon, which was one of my favorite movies this year as well. Did you guys all see that?
That's because, unlike some of the other pictures that came out last year, Moon was actually about something.
What are you referring to, David?
Well, I don't know. It's just,
so, I don't know.
Plots.
Everything.
Plots, structure, meaning, the speech at the end that Kirk gives about the lesson we learned from our little adventure that was sadly missing.
I think you have some deep thoughts about this, don't you?
Yeah, we could go there if we wanted to. Yeah.
I think we'll have to at some point. Okay. We'll get to that shortly. We also had another awards going on here at Dragon Con, actually.
Yes, the Parsec Awards were announced last night. So congratulations to Scott Sigler, who won Best Speculative Fiction Story for The Tank. Personal Effects, Sword of Blood by J.C. Hutchins won Best Speculative Fiction Story Novella Form. And Captain Cher by Nathan Lowell, Best Speculative Fiction Story Long Form. And Best Speculative Fiction Audio Drama, the Metamore City Podcast, Whispers in the Wood by Chris Lester.
And we did not win our Parsec Award, unfortunately. Those damn signals.
Well, that's because you guys weren't out there voting, you know.
We just have to change the podcast to be all about Firefly. And then we'll win. Is that what it comes down to? Like, we need to be more specific. We need to pick something. Like...
So, David, tell us your favorite episode of Firefly.
The one with the train.
Oh, that is a really good one,
great train
actually.
Robbery. Yeah, that was robbery. Fun.
I just watched that on the plane, actually, on the way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That is pretty specific.
Although, all in all, I think the best episode was the movie.
Because
it just put everything together nicely.
But it was so sad.
All right. Also on the calendar coming out this month, you may be aware or you may not, Zero History by William Gibson, set for release on Tuesday, September 7th. So depending on when you're hearing this podcast, it may already be out. And William Gibson's doing a big tour right now, so look for him around. He's going to all kinds of different cities.
Yeah, he's
going
to be in San Francisco on the 10th.
S.M. Sterling is on tour as well, and a couple other books coming out on the 7th. Charles Yu's How to Live Life Safely in a Science Fictional Universe and Ragnarok by P. Vanner.
Mm-hmm. And in case you were wondering what George R.R. Martin has been doing with his time over the past few years, he's been working on a graphic novel, and it's called Open Doorways, and it's coming out very soon, coming in November, and it looks pretty interesting, actually, but would you guys rather read a graphic novel, or would you rather read the next book in the Song of Ice and Fire series? Yeah. I'm just saying. we'll be nice to him, because he's not, after all, our bitch.
Well, Doorways was a television pilot that was on the edge of being greenlit into a series at one point and never made it to the screen, and so this is something he's been trying to do, is figure out an outlet for it.
Not to engage in unsavory gossip.
Ooh, yes, please.
Now that I have your attention, there was a particularly unethical vice president or whatever, I forget what his title was, over at Fox, and he would bring writers in to pitch, and if he heard something good, he'd steal the idea. Shows that were stolen was George R.R. Martin's Doorways was turned into Sliders, but George was not part of it, and another pitch became Space Above and Beyond, but the creators of that were not part of it. And there's enough circumstantial evidence to demonstrate that this was a pattern of behavior on this particular individual, whose name shall remain unmentionable, but he's now over at Showtime working as a producer on some series over there, and I wish him only the worst.
So they steal all the good ideas, and yet they cancel all the good shows.
Well, nobody ever said you were smart working in a studio. I mean, it's if you want to be a studio person, you're not going to be a writer. If you want to be a writer-producer who cares about storytelling, for some reason you can't be a studio person at the same time. It doesn't seem to work.
It's just two streams that never cross.
Yeah, don't cross the streams.
Also, finally, Neal Stephenson has unveiled his digital novel platform, The Mongoliad, about the Mongol invasion of Europe, using the Pulp platform for creating digital novels. It's still mostly a text novel, but authors can add additional material like background articles, images, music, and video. Stevenson said, I can remember reading Dune for the first time, and I started by reading the glossary. Any book that had that kind of extra stuff in it was always hugely fascinating to me. So this is an attempt to use the web as a way to extend the story. Have you heard much about this, David? Do you have a thought
on it? Well, I remember back in, even before the web was invented, a fellow named Ted Nelson postulated, he wrote a huge book about hyperlinking, and that this was only possible with computers. And so the web is actually gives us that hyperlinking of knowledge. I don't think we're anywhere near the possibilities yet, although as when I'm sitting and working, as thoughts occur to me, it's like there's Google and there's Wikipedia. It's instant research. I don't have to go to the library. I don't have to go to the bookstore and buy shelf loads of reference books. I mean, I must have bought thousands of dollars of reference books, and they're all obsolete now, thanks to Google and Wikipedia. Although you got to double check, because not everything you see on Google is accurate, and not everything you see on Wikipedia is accurate. And I give you a great story on this one. This guy wrote a column on his blog pointing out that you shouldn't trust everything on Wikipedia or everything you read on Google, because, you know, it's human beings. And at the beginning of it, he has this quote: I'm all in favor of keeping dangerous weapons out of the hands of fools. Let's start with typewriters. And ascribes the quote to Frank Lloyd Wright. The irony there is that the information, that quote is wrong. I wrote that quote in Chapter 6 of A Matter for Men back in 1992. It's been all over the internet that Frank Lloyd Wright said it, but I said it. I wrote it. And here's this guy complaining about you can't trust anything on the internet, and his opening quote is wrong.
Wow.
You just can't trust anything.
I don't trust anybody.
Yeah. I think that's the moral of that story.
Awesome.
Anyway, check out the Mongoliad, if you like, at mongoliad.com. There's already season one of the stories up. There's a shop where you can
That's a good-looking website.
Yeah, it is pretty nice.
Yeah,
it's a nice red website. The shop isn't open for buying, but you can subscribe. And you can poke around in the Pedia. It's not a Wikipedia, just a Pedia. That you can use to get some background on the characters and the nations involved and all of that.
Excellent. Well, we'll take a quick break for our sponsor. This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. Check it out at audiblepodcast.com/sword. That's audiblepodcast.com/sword.
All right, well, one of the main reasons that a lot of you are here and the main reason we're here is to talk with David Gerald. And
Gerald, actually.
Gerald, and I've done that millions of times.
Sorry
about
that.
Thank you for your patience on that, though. I didn't get a chance to ask you beforehand, so my apologies.
Could have been worse. You could have been calling me David.
David.
Which I wouldn't mind. My grandmother did that.
That does sound pretty fancy, yeah.
So, David, a lot of people... In this audience, how many of you are familiar with The Trouble with Tribbles? All of you. That's good. And
you can buy Tribbles in the Marriott dealer's room at booth A55.
Excellent. And how many of you came here because you're a fan of that episode and you wanted to hear David talk about it?
Thank you.
All right, thank
Yay,
you. That's
thank
all.
You.
We've had a great show.
No, there's
I'm
nothing else
for.
To say about R2 Tribbles.
R2-D2
we said it all.
No,
yeah, okay. But, I mean, there's nothing really more to say about it. So.
Well, I am interested about it.
Oh,
I was
right.
excited about
well,
it.
Well, we'll bore them.
Yeah, so put up with it.
Yeah, deal with it.
What?
Oh, they're leaving already.
Now, I know Tribbles was not
Aren't
the...
Aren't you a little short to be a stormtrooper?
Oh, he's so cute.
I know.
A funny thing happened. I was in the elevator. It's totally packed. The door opens. There's no room for two stormtroopers to get in. Somebody says, "This is not the elevator you're looking for." Two stormtroopers say, "This is not the elevator we're looking for. Move along."
That's awesome. Tom, you should tell your anecdote about the.
Oh yeah, I was walking into the hotel and a bunch of zombies were standing outside because there was I don't know if it was a zombie wedding reception, but they're all in bridal gear. And a bunch of guys in LSU jerseys come walking down the street here for the football game, and they see him and they yell, "Nerds!" And the zombies yell, "Brains!" Made my weekend right there.
Oh, so
I love it.
So for those who don't already know, which is all of them apparently, how did the Trouble with Tribbles script come about? Tell us a little bit of
well,
that.
Well, as some of you, or most of you, or probably all of you know, the first episode of Star Trek was Thursday night, 8:30, NBC, September 6th, 1966. And I had seen like one or two trailers and said, "Oh yeah, right, this will be another Lost in Space." But I figured I'll give it 1 hour, right? And it was the Man Trap episode, and I'm being very skeptical. I'm a longtime science fiction fan, like since I was about 2 years old, and I'm being, "What is this transporter beam crap? Give me a break, you know?" And pointed ears and no emotions? That character's not going to be around long, you know, with no emotions. He's going to be very uninteresting. And I'm very skeptical. But then they beam down to the planet, and they're doing alien archaeology, and this alien pyramid has oversized blocks and the doorways are shaped weird, and said, "Hey, somebody got it. You know, the art director got it about an alien culture." Now I'm starting to get interested. And at the end of the episode, I said, "I know they're going to screw this up, but this show has great possibilities. It could be like Forbidden Planet." So I dashed off and wrote an outline for them. I was a film student at USC, and I knew script format and outline format. I dashed off and wrote a nice outline, which my agent submitted to them on Monday. And Tuesday or Wednesday, we got a call saying, well, we're all booked up for the, we're not buying anything, but we're really impressed with what your young writer did. Please send him in for a meeting. And I went in, I met Gene L. Kuhn, and he said, submit some stories for our second season. So I started writing up stories, and I pitched an idea about little fuzzy creatures that get out of control, and he says, that sounds expensive. I don't think we'd want to do that. But I wrote it up anyway. And my five outlines hit the desk of Dorothy Fontana, and she wrote a memo. I've been teasing her about it for 40 years now. This one has some whimsy. Why don't we buy the story and assign a real writer? No. That was fair. And
you never have to pay for a meal with her, do you?
Yeah, no, never, actually. And in fact, I'll be seeing her next week. We're going to see Walking with Dinosaurs. Which is kind of like visiting the studio and seeing their latest blockbuster picture, but we call it Walking with Dinosaurs. Anyway, Gene L. Kuhn called me in and said, listen, we're going to buy your story, but we're not going to sign it to a script writer, and we'll wait and see what you do in the next 2 weeks. So, of course, I went home and wrote a script and brought it in. He looked at it, and he says, this is pretty good. We'll buy it. And so he handed me the rewrite. And next thing I know, I had gone through a complete step deal from beginning to end and had my first script credential. And it was really funny because I was still didn't have a senior project to graduate from college. And so I just, you know, I turned it in. I said, here's my senior project, and which I was not in good odor in the drama department at CSUN at the time. And big deal. He went and he sold a script, and somebody said, you idiots, he went pro and you're still here. You know, so that was fun. And they had me, Gene had me come in and do an uncredited rewrite on iMUD. I did not ask for credit. I could have had it, sent it to the Guild for arbitration, but I said, no, Stephen Kandel created Harry Mudd, and I wouldn't feel right about taking away half his credit, because that would also be taking away half his residuals, and I just don't feel good about that. And I think that impressed Gene Kuhn a lot. Then we shot The Trouble with Tribbles in August of '67. I was on the set every day. And I will tell you, I was very shy. I still am.
You're doing a good job today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
come on,
so,
everybody, give him a little.
Yeah.
All right.
And I fake it well, yeah. Anyway, so I was afraid, you know, I met all the actors except Leonard Nimoy. I mean, I was just so intimidated by him. Fourth or fifth day, I'm on the set watching them shoot. They were shooting The Apple. A lot of funny things, you know, a lot of playing around. And then they shot The Doomsday Machine. And I shot The Doomsday Machine first, then The Apple. And I was on the set, and I was sitting, and I was reading every script that anyone would leave laying around, because they always had scripts two or three episodes ahead for the actors to study. So I was doing my on-the-job training, how to learn to write a Star Trek script. There's this hand on my shoulder. I've seen you around here for 3 or 4 days now. Who are you? And I turned around, it's Leonard Nimoy in full Spock drag. And I said, a script for you guys, and he says, which one? I said, The Trouble with Tribbles. And he says, oh yes, that looks like it'll be a lot of fun. Aww. And as it was really nice, and William Shatner was a good guy too. I mean, really friendly, and everybody else. And of course, the first time, then my favorite part of the whole experience was the first time I met Nichelle Nichols. She was eating her lunch, cottage cheese, and she was wearing the uniform from the Mirror Mirror episode.
You can only eat cottage cheese when you have to wear those.
Of which there was a lot more Nichelle and a lot less uniform.
It was inverse of what she normally wore, because it was
And a little piece of cottage cheese fell down her cleavage. And I really wanted to volunteer to be helpful and go get it, but
it's walking a fine line.
It's very, yeah. It was. I nearly passed out from lack of blood to my brain. And thank you. Somebody got it. And everybody. And then one day, there's this one fellow who I've seen 3 or 4 days, and I say, I've seen you around for, he says, oh, I'm playing Ensign Chekhov. And I go, oh, great, I have to give you all the Sulu's lines, because he's off doing the Green Berets with John Wayne. And so we talked about, he was excited because he was, you know, getting, he's really great, was, you know, Walter was now on a hit TV, well, not a hit series, but a series that looked like it was going to be a lot of fun to be on. And we didn't know it was going to be a hit. And so Walter and I have been buddies ever since, and because we both kind of grew up with Star Trek.
Now, I read something on Wikipedia, so I want to find out if it's actually true.
Oh, no.
did you originally name the Tribbles Fuzzies?
The script was called A Fuzzy Thing Happened to Me.
Oh, that's good.
And they were called Fuzzies. And Joan Pierce, who was our terrific person who did research to double-check names and that you weren't accidentally, you know, violating somebody's copyright, wrote a memo saying, well, H. Beam Piper wrote a book called Little Fuzzy, and this might be a conflict. I didn't think so, because the Little Fuzzies were more like little monkeys, little fuzzy primates. But Gene Elkoon said, you got to come up with another name. So I went home and made up a list of, I mean, 2 pages of just writing down the silliest words, man, I could think of.
I would pay a lot of money for that list.
Yeah, so would I. I threw it away. I mean, if I knew that. But I just, you know, then I just crossed off all the words that were too silly, and the only one that was left was, and I did a lot of, you know, what can I do with Triffid? Okay, Triffid's been used. What can I do, you know, Triffid or, you know, finally ended up, stumbled into Tribbles, and the more I'm looking at it, the more I think, okay, so I walked back into the studio the next day, and I said, well, I think we could call them Tribbles, and that means we could call the episode The Trouble with Tribbles, and Gene Okun goes, yeah, that'll work. And that was it. I mean, it was, you would think there was a lot of brainstorming,
right,
and a
right.
light, yeah. You know, and magic and violins and harps and choruses, you know, hallelujah. No, it's just, yeah, Tribbles is fine. Let me share a story with you. You're going to love this. The night the episode was aired, I had a party at my house and invited all of my friends from college. And one of them was a fellow named Bob Englund, who some of you may know as Freddy Krueger. After the episode aired, he said, David, this was really terrific. You did much better than I expected. And I mean, you really have talent, and I'm so proud of you. And he's going on a little too long. And I said, Bob, stop. It's only one episode of one TV series. 20 years from now, nobody's going to remember it. Who knew?
Yeah, right.
I didn't know you guys were all out there watching the show.
So what was it like transitioning to novels after writing for TV?
Well, it was a lot. In one respect, it's a lot easier because you don't have somebody telling you, the uniforms don't have pockets. You don't have somebody working you over on the details. You get to be boss. In another respect, it's a lot harder because you're in charge of all the details. And if there's a mistake, you don't get to blame the actor or the director or the editor. It's all yours. But I was living in New York for a while, and I'd wake up every morning and I'd write a chapter. And if I got my chapter finished, then I could go out and boogie around New York. I ended up finishing like 3 novels in something like 6 weeks, you know. But it really is. It's difficult. You work your way up to. It's kind of like learning how to be a sprinter or a jogger. You start with the 100-yard dash, then you work your way up the quarter mile, then the mile, and, you know, because you're working your way up from 3,000 words to 7,000 to 100,000 words, and that's a lot of typing. And if you figure 8 pages a day and your book is 400 pages long, that's a lot of time spent. But I was a pretty fast typist. There were days I was doing 25, 30 pages a day, so... But you have to go back and rewrite and polish and in television you get all these wonderful memos from people reacting to things that you've typed, whereas when you go back and do your own editing, it's kind of like you're having this conversation with your previous self. Boy, I can't believe you were stupid enough to write that, you know? And they rewrite. So in the days of typewriters, what I did was I had this wonderful IBM Selectric typewriter. It's just gorgeous. A little infuriated golf ball goes back and forth. It was great fun, and you can change the typeface by putting a different golf ball. But what I would do is, I was on page, let's say 87, and I went back and made a correction on page 37 in order to have absolutely perfect pages. I would keep typing as I make the correction, type up a brand new page. And if it went 2 lines long, I'd keep typing, and I'd end up rewriting the book as I was writing it, and it got better and better. So I noticed that was it made my writing better because I learned a lot that way.
Do you have a book in the works right now?
Always.
What's anything you can tell us about?
Well, let's see. There's the fifth book of The War Against the Torah called A Method for Madness. Thank you. And I'm determined to get that finished in the next 4 to 6 months. I have a book that it takes place in the War Against the Torah universe. It's a prequel about how they invented the mode training. Then there's three novellas, 40,000 word novellas that have all been published on Jim Bain's universe. And I want to expand them into full novels because there's more to each story. I only had to stop because the limit was 40,000 words. And then I'm helping Jim Spostow finish Gene Robinson's last script based on Stardance. And I'm doing a manga for Tokyo Pop based on StarCraft. We just finished Volume 2, which I think just came out. Yeah. And we're working on Volume 3. It's called Ghost Academy.
Is this in the Wings of Liberty universe?
Yeah, it's actually the one we're working on involves the ghost training. And if you, how many have played StarCraft 2 yet? And you've met Tosh?
Yes.
The guy with the dreadlocks?
Yeah.
Well, this story is a prequel where you find out a lot. If you read the Ghost Academy series, you will see why and how Tosh became the way he is. I can't give anything away because it's all under NDA. But Tosh and Nova, who are both in the StarCraft II game, have an incredible backstory, and I'm in the middle of writing it right now. I have to turn in Chapter 4 on Tuesday.
I just played that campaign last week where you have to pick whether to help out Tosh or the...
Or Nova.
I
haven't decided. I'm stuck on that. I haven't decided which one to support because I know these characters so intimately. Well.
We should take a poll. Who went with Tosh?
And who went with Nova?
Boo, okay. Brian.
Were there advantages in going with Nova?
She was pretty.
She was pretty. All
you right. Should see some of the artwork that I have on Nova. was there any advantages going with Tosh?
He's a badass.
He kicks ass.
Okay. All right.
I went with Tosh. Right, the Spectres get some different powers. That's true.
Okay.
That's very cool.
So I'm busy.
Yeah, that's awesome. The StarCraft universe is so rich and full of stuff. It seems like you could just write forever in that area.
Well, yeah. And they're big sticklers for accuracy.
Oh, yeah.
So the script gets reviewed before the artist even gets it. The script gets reviewed about 6 times, not just by my editor, but by a whole team of guys who say, no, she wouldn't use that gun, she'd use this gun, or please don't use this word, please use that word. And I don't mind that kind of meticulous care on the details. I rather appreciate it because then I don't have to worry about it. I can focus on the character, which is what I'm best at, is doing character.
Yeah, we could have a whole podcast talking about that, I'm sure. But going back to Star Trek a little bit, what characters do you miss the most, do you miss writing for?
Well, my favorite characters are, it's the triangle of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And I love McCoy more than any other character on Star Trek because he can say, everybody else is being polite. And McCoy will just say, whatever emotional thing comes to mind. He's very authentic, very honest guy. I really like McCoy. And D. Kelly was probably the sweetest, nicest of the whole gang of seven. But ultimately, it's more fun to write the triangle because, and I've done actually 3 hours of scripts for Star Trek Phase Two, the internet series, and it was just a great chance to go back and work with Kirk, Spock, and McCoy again. And the best scenes in both of those, Blood and Fire and Origins, the best scenes are the ones with Kirk, Spock, and McCoy interacting with each other. Spock is easy to write in one sense because he's very, the Spock box and he's not going to get out of it. In Origins, we're going back to the Pike era Enterprise and young Kirk and young Spock are aboard it. And Dr. Boyce says to Spock, this was my favorite line in the script, says, Why, Mr. Spock, that sounded like a feeling. Next you'll be telling me you have hopes. And Spock says, yes, I do. Someday I hope to be on a starship without a sarcastic doctor. So because I didn't have McCoy there, I still wanted to have McCoy there.
That's great.
And if you look at Blood and Fire on YouTube, there's a scene in part two where they're arguing over who's going to volunteer for a suicide mission and where you get your blood infected with this god-awful stuff. And Kirk says, no, you can't. I can't allow anyone to volunteer. And Spock and McCoy get into an argument about it. And McCoy says, well, if you're so damned logical and you think this is the only way, Spock says it's the only way. McCoy says, well, then why don't you volunteer? And Spock says, well, unfortunately, my blood is unsuitable, but yours, however. And so it's fun to write that relationship because there's such mutual love that is expressed as a kind of a tension between all of these characters.
Yeah. That's how Tom and I interact all the time.
Yeah, pretty. I'm the logical, bloodless one.
Okay. Huh?
I have no comeback.
I can see that.
All right, well, we also solicited some questions from our book club members on the Goodreads forum, so we have some of those we'd like to ask you as well. Jonathan wrote, I'd like to know what David thought of the Deep Space Nine episode Trials and Tribulations, since he wrote the original series Tribble episode.
I thought they did a brilliant job. I read the script about 2 days before they started shooting, and I just laughed my butt off the whole way through the script. It was one of the most brilliant pieces of television writing I have ever read. And the way they folded the whole story together and had fun with the original series and the original script. And then when it was shot and they matched the accuracy of the original look and feel and did those great effects, I think it's one of the best hours of television I've ever seen.
I always wanted, after I saw that episode on Deep Space Nine, I wanted to go and re-edit the original to put those scenes back in and then watch the original with just Avery Brooks in the background. Sort of see what it felt like from that.
That would have been fun, yeah. Would have been fun.
I'm surprised somebody hasn't done that.
No,
he was upstairs. You should go recommend it.
Over at CBS, when they put together the Blu-ray of the original series, the high def. So if you want to see the original series in HDTV, and I truly recommend it, you have never seen it look so good. I mean, we used to look at the dailies. It was 35 millimeter film, just like for the movies at the time. And we were the first ones who'd ever seen that piece of film go through a projector. So it was pristine and beautiful and perfect. And the high def, they went back to the original negatives, did the whole remastering, took out dirt and speckles, no jiggle and everything, and it looks as good as you will ever see. And then you can watch it with the original effects or with the remastered, updated effects. And there's all kinds of extras and commentaries and interviews. And what I was most gratified or privileged or honored by is one disc in the season two is all Tribbles. So it's all three Tribble episodes, the original, the Deep Space Nine, the animated, and all kinds of Tribble trivia. So.
Very cool. We also got a question from George, who asks, you wrote one of the best ever time travel paradox novels, The Man Who Folded Himself. Modern physics and cosmological research intimates that time travel might be possible in some rather limited ways. Have you considered revisiting that ground?
Yeah, actually, the last time we republished The Man Who Folded Himself about 3-4 years ago, maybe it's longer than that. My time sense is off.
That's ironic.
Or something like that.
Yeah. No, it happens to you when you have kids. It's I adopted a little boy in 1992, and two things happen. After your first kid, you gain weight, and it's all that damn pizza he kept ordering. But also, time seems to collapse on itself. Because he's 26 now, and I don't remember that happening. Yeah, I mean, there's two or three stories I could, about how time machines tend to uninvent themselves. But the last time I reread the book, and remember, I wrote it 40 years ago, I was rereading it, and I thought, God, this hero is shallow and unlikable and just a real nerd. And I really didn't like him that much. But he grows up in the course of the book. So I thought that was interesting, was that even while I was very young writing that book, I was still writing a book about the discovery of maturity. It amazed me that the book got the response it did. You know, I go back, I look at my earlier stuff, it's totally cringeworthy, and, you know, I hope audiences won't notice, but but I'm amazed that the book has lasted, is considered a classic. I'm really thrilled by and delighted by it. It's like I always wanted to do something memorable other than Tribbles.
Yeah, well, now you've got a few in your hat.
Yeah.
Halbert 42 wrote, in the first couple of Thor books, he does some amazing imagining of what an alien ecosystem might be like, culminating in the worms, of course. I'd like to know what sparked that idea, what terrestrial organisms he used.
Well, that's a great question. There was... I had been... My favorite movies of the 50s were Them and War of the Worlds, so you can sort of see how there was this collision of... and then I was in England in 70 or 71. This brilliant biologist named Jack Cohen did a wonderful panel presentation on alien life forms, and he talked about... he would believe in Tribbles because he could find creatures on Earth that had equivalent, or he believed in various things. If you can find an equivalent behavior, an equivalent creature that does something, he'll believe it as an alien. But if you make up something, and so he says, like Larry Niven's three-legged puppeteers, he can believe them, but the three-legged part, it doesn't exist anywhere in nature. So it's a difficult stretch, you see. So that stuck in my mind, and I got back to the States, and I went to a convention in Boston, was sitting around with Rick, he was the one of the guys working on the art department of Star Trek, and my brain is the artist. Huh? Sternbach, right. Ooh. Rick Sternbach and Russell Seitz and a bunch of others, and we're just brainstorming, and I started brainstorming that I had this notion about an alien invasion, but without spaceships, it would be all biological, and we just started inventing, and Sternbach drew a worm for me, and at the time, I had the worms living in trees, jumping down on people, but the more I started putting the pieces together, every time, everything's connected to everything else, and the more you start thinking, well, what do they eat? Or how do they breed? What is their psychology? What's their growth cycle? And how does this affect what humans are going to see? And the fact, one of the things that still hasn't come out, might come out in book 5 or 6, is that their ecology, as they're here on Earth, is evolving to adapt to Earth. So what we're seeing isn't even what their ecology is. And but basically, over the last 30 years, the whole thing has been evolving. People raise questions, or something occurs to me, or I realize something. My stack of notes on the project is much longer than the actual drafts of the book. I mean, I must have like 3 million words of notes and outlines, and the books come out at 250,000 words each, so you figure it out.
Have you thought about doing something like Stevenson, where you create sort of a resource?
Yeah, there's going to be a Torrent encyclopedia at some point. Excellent. If only to keep the author sane.
Yeah, of course.
So, go ahead.
All right. Folks who listen to the podcast know that our current reading selection is Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein. We'll be wrapping that up in our next episode. Have you read that?
Only about six or seven times. I think it's one of Heinlein's absolute best books. It perfectly structured. Brilliant book. I love the brass cannon story in it.
Yeah, there's some great telling details that are nestled inside there. If you had to give us, since you won't be able to be there for our actual wrap-up episode, one sort of thought to throw into the conversation to maybe get us kicked off, what would you say?
Well, I would just say, no spoilers, please. I've not finished yet. Thank you.
Okay. I would say that what Heinlein is doing is asking a question, just what kind of a government do you want? And what are you willing to do to have it happen? What are you willing to do to make it, to create it? And while essentially the story was a kind of a retelling of the American Revolution, Heinlein was actually asking some very pertinent questions to get you thinking about government. But for my reading, I think the key point is where the revolution breaks out before the architects of the revolution are ready to have it happen. And that once is, you know, once you start heating up the pot, it's going to boil over, and you have no idea when or how, but it will boil over. And
They just have to ride the wave. Do you need to take that?
No.
No, I always got it.
Music out of nowhere.
No, it's
soundtrack
like
of our lives.
Things take on a life of their own. And like you said, if you're not ready for them, it's going to be...
I think Heinlein wrote a lot of good books. I think that, Starship Troopers, and some of his juveniles you can't understand science fiction as a genre until you've read Heinlein's better books. I used to think Stranger in a Strange Land was one of his better books, but I've marked it down a notch or two because he stacked the deck.
Yeah, it was interesting. We had put this up to a fan vote, and it was interesting to me that Moon rose to the top as a selection rather than Stranger in a Strange
Land. Now, of course, Starship Troopers was made into a film.
No, it was made into a dreadful film.
Oh, well, I was going to say, as someone who has written for TV before, do you think that The Moon is a Harsh Mistress would make a better film? I know that there has been a script that's been leaked out from 2005.
I think Moon is a Harsh Mistress could be a brilliant movie if it were done with some scientific accuracy about showing that people are going to walk differently on the moon. Gravity, in 1/6 gravity, and this is, if you go back to the Bouncing Off the Moon book I did, a large part of it is about the adjustments and adaptations you have to make to survive on the moon. Furniture is different. Anything that deals with liquid is going to be different because liquid, you know, you do that with a cup of coffee on Earth, coffee will go a little bit. You do that on the moon, it hits the ceiling. Stuff like that. Toilets are going to be shaped differently if you think about splash effects. And so
try not to, though.
Yeah, and staircases or ladders. I mean, everything on the... So if The Moon is a Harsh Mistress truly were to represent an accurate view of lunar life, I think it could be a brilliant book, a brilliant movie. But boiling down all of the stuff about, well, there's the contract family and how you do the revolution and, you know, all that, I think it would take somebody with the skill of a Stanley Kubrick or a Joss Whedon or, you know, somebody who wants to do more than just a, you know, one more smash the Earth with asteroid story.
Oh, I'd love to see Joss Whedon take that on. All right, we've got about 15 minutes or so left, so we're going to open up to audience questions. If you have a question, we have a microphone over here that we can stop doing that.
Ooh,
that's a stimulation for you to ask a question. It's going to keep making that noise until you come up with one.
Yes, and beatings will continue until morale improves.
Just raise your hand and the mic will come to you, and please do not be shy. What happens here? Oh, here we've got one guy right over here. Once this gets going, of course, then everybody decides they want to have a question. So raise your hand big over there so we can find you. There we go. We're coming to you. Please be patient. Thank you for holding. Your question is very important to us. Okay.
Another great book by Heinlein, I was just thinking, is Have Spacesuit Will Travel.
I love Heinlein. There's a couple of things I could ask, but I'll just pick one. When I go to a bookstore nowadays, and I go to the science fiction section, and I look at the section that says new in science fiction, what I see nowadays are werewolves, vampires, more what I would call fantasy-based stuff, which I love fantasy, but it makes me wonder, why are we seeing less and less kind of quote-unquote hard science fiction on the shelves nowadays? Is the genre, I don't say dying, but is it undergoing a change? Is it this?
The genre is undergoing a change. I'm going to tell you, it's a cultural thing. Our whole society, you're not going to like this answer, none of you are. Our society has gotten very complex. To keep up with science, I mean, you know, in the 40s and 50s, you know, jet engines, space travel, you know, go to the moon, and that was science, maybe computers. And if you look at the science fiction, what was in the magazines in the 40s and 50s, it was pretty understandable. Today, when you start to deal with, they're talking things like string theory, of which even the 12 people in the world who think they know what they're talking about probably don't. Bioengineering, I mean, you know, even most of us back in the 70s, most of us who had home computers knew how to program them ourselves. Today, most people who have computers, you know, if they can't download an application, they don't do it. I mean, what I'm saying is we're at the tipping point of idiocracy. the marching morons, in that we've made our lives so easy, while our world gets more complex, it's easier to be a know-nothing. And this explains certain political movements of people who are anti-science. They don't want science because it destroys the nice, simple, easy answer. You know, intelligent design. Well, first assume God, you know. What has happened is science has lost credibility in the thinking of the world. And so science fiction, as being the dream of what we can build, has kind of faded away because it's a lot easier to play with orcs and elves and vampires. Real vampires don't sparkle, by the way. I may do my own vampire story, and it will not be nice. Man, that young girl walks up, she's lunch, she is not. It's like, why would somebody who's immortal be interested in a brain-dead bimbette? You know, what intellectual stimulation does she provide? I'm saying that we are amusing ourselves to death with television, the internet, etc., whereas the real adventure in life is what can you discover, what can you build, what can you create, who can you connect with, how do you expand your consciousness? And we as a culture we've become grown-up babies. What new toys can we... Oh, look, a new iPhone. Oh, shiny. And as a culture, that's what we're, you know... Oh, a 3D movie. And we're doing it to ourselves. I just got to have a new 3D TV set. Does that answer your question?
Hey, say what you will about vampires, but don't talk smack on orcs, okay?
Hey, don't I would never there. Insult my ex. Wait.
Too late.
Orcs or iPhones, for that matter.
Yeah, look, I mean, Apple does some great products. I'm not an Apple, and I know Apple sponsors this show, so I won't say anything.
No.
I tend to be, but I grew up with PCs, and because I like to take them apart and put them back together and do my own programming. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the ironies, because everything you say is true about us amusing ourselves to death, but at the same time, we have a more expansive and growing audience of makers and people who do those things themselves. And perhaps the hope of humanity lies in them.
I agree with you on this. There's something happening that's very exciting, and it is in the area of independent film and independent music recording, in that... now that the tools of filmmaking have dropped to, you know, you can buy a Canon EOS 7D for like $1,600-$1,700 and make a high-def video movie, and your sound editing, you know, Audacity, it's free. Your video editing, you can get a decent video editing program for less than $100. You can be in business to make your own movie for, you know, less than $5,000. And there's films like Primer that have been made that way. And what we're seeing all over YouTube and the internet is small groups of people, independent filmmakers. And the comparison, which is where Star Trek Phase Two, you know, demonstrates that the studios are big lumbering dinosaurs, and pretty soon the little egg-sucking therapsids are going to take over that particular ecology. The big $100 billion blockbuster is that's a disaster if it doesn't turn out. And God, you know, I mean, this year, a lot of them did not. So this thinking that we have to spend $100 million to make Transformers 3, just because Transformers 2 made a lot of money, is like, man, I'd rather stick my head in a trash can and have someone bang on it for 2 hours. Than
And you can put that on YouTube and actually make a little money.
It'd be more peaceful, too.
You can probably get Megan Fox to do that. She's looking for work, I'm sure. All right, do we have another question? Sorry.
Hi, this is for Tom and Veronica. I live down in Rio de Janeiro, and I host a reading group to try to expose learners of English to epic fantasy from the 70s and 80s that is really overlooked now, specifically Stephen R. Donaldson, Thomas Covenant books, and Catherine Kurtz, the Derrynee series. Any chance of future podcasts looking back into the 70s and 80s? Because these guys are still writing books now, but they're not getting the publicity that other authors are getting. So could you look back...
Like an episode where we do sort of a review? Is that
not necessarily, maybe 5 minutes, you know, like instead of what's coming out next, you know, next month, what came out, you know, 20 years ago, and these books are really still good.
I like that.
And
it's sort of
they're
a calendar.
Great. Exactly.
Yeah. That's a good idea. Yeah, I think we could definitely try that. That'd be fun.
And that's the kind of thing that easily fills up 5 minutes for us, and that we don't have to go search around for news.
And you know what we haven't done? We've done a lot of
very
looking,
efficient.
We've done a lot of looking back on sci-fi, like classic sci-fi, but we haven't really done a lot of classic fantasy either in our book pick, so that might be a fun thing to do as well.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Thanks. And email some of the ones that you mentioned so I remember them to swordandlaser@gmail.com.
Okay, I just had it from the bald guy.
Okay, yeah, with guide on his shirt. I'll remember. Any other questions? Do we have somebody right here in the front? Yeah.
Thank you.
My question is this. So we're all influenced as we grow up, and that kind of makes us who we are today. My question is, what was, if you could pick one moment that really made you say, okay, science fiction, that's where I'm going to be. What was that moment in your life, you would say?
Yeah, it really is. I would probably say it was... I had this kind of unconscious competition going with this. He was supposedly my best friend. I hated him. But if he was reading a book, I had to read it. So he started reading Walter Rollins' books, classic series, Freddy the Pig. So I read every single one. And then I saw he was reading Dr. Doolittle, and I read every single one. And then I was in the library, and I was looking for something else to read. This voracious 9-year-old reader who was in. I found a book called Rocket Ship Galileo, and I would say that was it. I mean, doomed. It was like, here, kid, the first one's free. that was in the kids section. When I went through all of the science fiction, there was like six. I did something very precocious. I went and looked in the card catalog. And nobody had taught me how to use the card catalog, but I saw other people looking, so I went and looked, and then, oh, Heinlein, okay. Oh, there's another whole shelf of Heinlein over here. Well, that was it. And because next to Heinlein, there was Asimov, and then Sturgeon, and Van Vogt, and Fred Pohl, and Cyril Kornbluth, and Murray Leinster, and Fritz Leiber. And by the time I had worked my way through those two or three shelves of books, because they kept getting new ones circulating from the Central Library, but by the time I'd worked my way through most of that, next thing I knew, I was like 16. I was reading a book a day, and I was hitting the used bookstores to you know, coming home with 20 or 30 books. Okay, I'm good for the next month, and you know, and I wasn't paying attention to anything that was going on in school. You know, it was like they'd assign homework, and I didn't bother to listen to what was going on in the class. Yeah, I'd go home and do the homework and say, okay, yeah, that's fine. But I don't think, I think there are some textbooks I never opened and still passed the course. One time I was in an economics course in high school, I panicked and said, this one I might have to study. And I went and studied, and the first test was so easy. It's like I got the highest grade in the class, like 99. And I thought, well, that was way too easy. I never bothered to study again. Still passed the class.
Positive reinforcement, right?
No, I was learning.
If there's any kids in the audience, maybe.
So no, I was learning advice. More from reading the hard science books, but Heinlein and Asimov and Robert Silverberg, you know, all these other guys. I was learning more from reading science fiction, a lot more. And I think you talk about turning points. One day I asked one of my math teachers if he had heard of the term Google, and he says, you've got to stop reading comic books. Mm. You know, which is, you know, it's this incredibly long number. I forget, it was like one followed by 100 zeros or whatever it is. And he made fun of me. And I knew that he was wrong, because I knew the term Google. I'd seen it in Scientific American by then or something. And I knew... this guy isn't a math teacher anymore. He's just a pizza delivery guy, you know, in a suit. And all he's delivering is side angle side, and, you know, it's like, screw this.
And by transitive, he was useless to me.
Yeah. And then, of course, I think the final turning point was I took a writing class in junior college. And the writing instructor said to me, kid, you're wasting my time, you're wasting your time, you're never going to be a writer, give it up, go away, do something else. And that pissed me off so much that 2 years later I sold The Trouble with Tribbles to Star Trek.
It is a common story, yeah. That's it's sort of like, it takes that one person to totally show disbelief in something you know you can do to kick you in the pants.
I think the two most powerful words in the English language are you can't. Because my reaction is always, yeah, I'll show you, you bastard.
All right. Well, we have time for one more question, if anyone's got one, either for us or for David.
You can't ask one more.
Great.
Oh, okay.
Hi. My name's Zan, and I saw you guys last year.
Thank
you. And now that it's Sunday, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the difference between your first experience at DragonCon and how it's been going for you this time, and what you do when you're not in panels. What are you finding that you enjoy here?
I got to ask Anne a question. If it's Sunday, why are you still wearing your yarmulke?
Well, I do have this.
Okay.
Not a yum.
You can say that in public? Okay. Okay.
For the listening audience, I'm dressed as R2-D2.
Yeah. Well, let's see. We don't have a lot of free time when we're here. I think I was on 4 panels this year, so it's hard to get around and see everything that you want to see. I didn't get to like the show floor area or Artist Alley yet. I'm hoping to try to get over there before this is all over. But mostly for me, it's about seeing all our friends that you know we get to see one time a year. Our comic book friends, our sci-fi fantasy friends, like everyone who's working in the industry that comes here to do their thing. It's just so wonderful to be able to get together. Even half of my guild is here. You know, for Warcraft. Yeah, AIE.
For the Horde.
For the Horde. And so it's a nice experience. It's like vacation for us. And the past 2 years, I mean, it's so much bigger this year, it feels like already. Like, just, it's grown so much in one
you
year.
You actually got to see something? I've spent most of my convention on that passageway between the two hotels.
Yeah,
the Skywalk.
45 minutes between Hyatt and Hilton. That's how long it takes.
I'll tell you, the most fun thing for me was actually with friends who are here for the first time. This is my second time. And so watching Justin Robert Young and Brian Brushwood sort of experience the parade and walking through, because we did a lot of live streaming for live.twit.tv, and just seeing the look in their eyes, like kid in the candy store, and understanding, like, this is the best thing ever.
Yeah.
Like, how did I miss this before? And just
so intense.
Double Dragon Con.
All the way. You know what else is funny is last year we interviewed Timothy Zahn, who of course wrote for the Star Wars universe, and this year we're talking to David, who of course is Star Trek, so that's interesting. I wonder what we're going to get next year.
Yeah, David, do you have any insight in who we should try to book for next time?
I think you should get somebody from Firefly.
Ah. All right, done. I like that.
Yes. That
ladies
would be
and gentlemen,
awesome.
Big thanks to David Gerald, now that I can pronounce his name right. And if you could, David, remind folks where they can find your books or anything you need to
Well, you go on to Amazon. Well, if you want to get Tribbles, go over to the dealer's room at the Marriott booth, 855. They also have The Martian Child over there, which is a terrific book. I think it's one of the best things I've ever done. The movie was a good movie, but the book is better. And but also you can go on Amazon and look me up on Amazon. There's a lot of my stuff there. I would recommend starting with Jumping Off the Planet, yeah, which was written in the style of a Heinlein juvenile, and the best review we got for it was that if Heinlein's editor had read this book, she'd have died of a heart attack, because we went in the planning and the writing went far beyond what Heinlein was able to do in the 50s, and made it a much more visceral book. So I thank Heinlein for setting the standard, the target for me to hit.
And don't forget to check out our partner StickerFu, StickerFu. Use the code SWORD1. You get 10% off. I almost gave away his stickers. 10% off the stickers at StickerFu.com.
And if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at theswordandlaser@gmail.com. Check out the website, swordandlaser.com, and visit our Goodreads forums at goodreads.com. Search for The Sword and Laser. And we also have t-shirts upstairs at our booth across from the Grand Ballroom if you want to come say hello and check us out.
Thanks, everybody, for coming.
Thank you.